Okay, we're getting right on time for 7 o'clock. So I'm going to ask people in the room here to take a seat. We're going to get going. And everybody on the Zoom, I'm going to mute all as usual. And as usual, well, I'm not even going to let you unmute yourself on this because there's no point. Well, actually, there is a point. I'm going to allow you to unmute yourself. The way that it's working with the hybrid here is that the people in the room are not going to be able to hear anybody that is on the Zoom. So if you have any comments or questions, you can do it audibly and I'll relay it on, or you can put it in the chat and I'll relay it that on. And the people here in the room are basically just seeing the Zoom session on another computer. So I think we are at 7, and we do have to get out of here before the library closes. So I think we will go ahead and get started. If Alan will re-show his deck. There we go. So Alan, take it away.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. Welcome everyone. We have thousands of people here and live in the studio. I don't think they can hear you right now. Okay.
Only the first 12 rows.
That was only the first 12 rows, yelling and screaming. Okay. First up, I have to apologize to Steve Parker because he sent in this question a couple of weeks ago, and I forgot to do the slide for last week. So his question is about virtual machines, and in particular, what's the best way to make a virtual machine for a Windows 10 Pro SSD on his upgraded Windows 11 Pro SSD? And that's going to make it easier for him to compare and customize things. And he's installed a whole bunch of VM software, VirtualBox, VMware Workstation, et cetera, et cetera. And he thought that Macrium VI Boot was going to be the easiest, but anytime he tried to access the image, the system crashed. And he said he was going to try SysInternals Disk2 VHD next. And I haven't heard, Steve, whether you've been successful with that, but if anybody has any bright ideas for Steve.
I got nowhere with that.
Yeah. So Steve is telling us that he hasn't won with that one either.
The main drawback to it was that the disk to VHD wanted to create a virtual disk that was 17,000 petabytes.
Wanted to create a virtual disk of 17 petabytes.
I'm sure you could if you have a big enough drive. Yeah, if anybody has any bright ideas that will help Chris, will help Steve, other than creating a 17 petabyte virtual machine, let us know in the chat or send us an email and we'll revisit it again. Okay, next up, it's the anniversary of Moore's Law, Chris.
You're going to give me a call?
Oh, I should do it. Oh, how? Can't get there from here. I'm on Zoom. I'm going sharing now.
You are sharing?
Yeah, I can't find it though. Oh, I have to share. Share that. Then, oh, there we are. So now it comes up. Slide control. Chris. Okay. That's good. Now we go from, no, I don't want to do that. I want to go from the beginning. There we go. Okay. Sorry about that technical glitch there.
Yeah, no problem. Okay, so I just came across this article the other day saying that it was 60 years ago, yesterday, day before, a couple of days ago, April 19th, 60 years ago that the Gordon Moore first proposed Moore's Law, which stated that he was predicting the number of transistors in integrated circuits would double each year, And he actually predicted it to run for at least 10 years. And it did. In 1975, he actually revised it to every 2 years. And it has been remarkably consistent ever since. And here's a chart of, that sort of talks a little bit about, the transistor doubling, but it's not as simple as doubling the transistors. It really comes into play with a lot of other aspects in terms of the overall performance of the computer. But there is no consensus currently on whether Moore's law will cease to apply. The current head of Intel says that it will not. It's near its end of life now. And I think that it's the opposite opinion is being held by the head of NVIDIA. So at any rate, a lot of smart people can't come to a consensus on that. And an interesting thing that came out of this was the capital cost of semiconductor fabrication plant actually increases exponentially. So even though they can generate these chips that can have higher and higher density transistors, the overall cost of these chips is actually going up considerably in terms of fabrication. So, that's all I had to say on that.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. And for those of you who joined because you want to know about badging Gmail, Chris is going to tell us all about it.
Yeah, this is kind of fun, actually, because I got into a little bit of trouble with Linda in particular. She emails me on my Gmail account, and she was always asking me why I was never picking up on her emails. And so it turns out that the Gmail app itself, if you run it as a progressive web app, it gets its own icon on the toolbar, and it was not badging to show you that we're on unread emails, unlike my Thunderbird client, which would show it. So I used two mail programs. Thunderbird, it does have that badging, and Gmail didn't have it. So this is the way it actually sort of looks. So the Gmail icon, I actually had unread emails, but it just shows normal, whereas the Thunderbird will actually give you a number for the number of unread emails. So that was a little bit of an annoyance. If I didn't happen to see it when it came in, with the pop-up, it would go away, and then I'd be working away at my computer, and I wouldn't notice that I had unread emails. So in order to get Gmail as a progressive web app in Chrome, I found it really, really nice rather than just in the web browser itself. So using Google Chrome, you go to your inbox, you click on the kebab menu, and then you go to More Tools, and you can create a shortcut. And you name that shortcut Gmail or whatever you want to call it. And there is a checkbox for Open as New Window, and you have to check that. And then it will open up in its own window that is a little bit less web browsy. It looks more like an application, standard application window. And once the new window opens up, you can right-click on the taskbar and say pin to taskbar, and then you can get to your Gmail anytime through that particular icon. So once you've done that, then I found that there is this extension in the Chrome Web Store that will give you badging. So if you go to the Chrome Web Store and you search for and install the extension called Gmail Taskbar Unread Badge, and you might need to restart Gmail that is running as a progressive web app. And also you need to make sure that your Windows setting for personalization taskbar behaviors, show badges on taskbar apps is enabled. And then you will actually get it. So in this case here, I have the Gmail app showing that there are two unread emails, and I still have my Thunderbird showing one unread email. So I find it really, really handy. So if you use Gmail as a progressive web app, highly recommended to get the badging of unread email. And I think that's all I have on that. Yep.
Okay. Thanks, Chris. Last week we had a question about Bing and Google, which was the best, and I looked at the chat afterwards, and there was a lot of people recommending DuckDuckGo as a search engine. And I've never really used DuckDuckGo, so I thought I would take a quick look at it. It's a free search engine, and one of the benefits, it's supposed to be very very it gives you good privacy, as opposed to some of these guys who call home all the time and use your clicks as ammunition to send you off to various adverts and things. DuckDuckGo is supposed to be good about doing things like that, or not doing things like that. So the way that you generally do it is you, in some kind of browser, you will pull up the settings, and somewhere in settings there will be a search option in the left-hand bar there. There's a search option. And if you do that, then you'll find that, in my case, Google was set as the default search engine, but I had the option of choosing other things. So I basically click on DuckDuckGo, and that sets DuckDuckGo as my search engine. So then I thought, well, I'll try and find something useful. So I put in the address bar there, OPSUG Q&A, and search with DuckDuckGo, and instantly it pulls up the website. And it actually, although it looks like it's just going to opcug.ca, and if you look at the text there, you can see that it's actually pulling up the text on the Q&A homepage. So the link is actually to opcug.ca/QA, the Q&A webpage. So it's basically going directly to what I asked it for. So that works really well. So then I thought, well, I'll check out the prices of flash drives in the Ottawa area. So I put in flash drives Ottawa, and this was the search results. And you notice the first two are Amazon and eBay, so buying flash drives essentially online. But also note that these are essentially paid adverts. And you can see where I circle there, the little ad icon tells you that these are paid adverts on DuckDuckGo. I guess they have to pay for DuckDuckGo somehow, and this is probably one of the ways, if not the only way, that they do it. But if you go further down, then you'll start to see some actual stores in Ottawa and Staples, and then below that, Best Buy, and so forth and so forth. So although it has some adverts, at least it's crystal clear that these are actually adverts. So I'll keep trying DuckDuckGo and see how it goes. But a lot of people recommended it, so if you're interested at all, then certainly try it out. And the other question that came in, not a question that came in, but topic that Chris has is, we had what, badging, and now we have quishing. So Chris, tell us all about quishing.
This was an interesting security podcast. So Smashing Security is a podcast that is hosted by Graham Cluley out of the UK. And he had this particular episode where at 1720 into this particular podcast, he started talking about quishing. So quishing is QR code phishing. So it's when you're trying to trick people into things through a QR code rather than just an email or a text message or something like that. So you get a QR code somehow, either in an email or a text message or anywhere you can see a QR code. And the problem is you don't know where it's going to take you. And there was a stat that came out, 12% of all phishing emails in the first half of last year actually contained a QR code, which seems to be a pretty high number. So different vulnerabilities that can come out of this, hijacking switch attacks. So this is where you'll actually have an illegitimate or fake QR code that is put over top of a legitimate QR code, and you're hoping that people will scan it and they'll be taken to your malicious site. This can happen in a restaurant menu. It could happen in a parking place where you can pay for parking. And you can do it by scanning QR codes. So somebody will come along, put their own malicious code on it, take you to some other site, you put in your credit card and to pay for parking, and you're actually just giving money to the scammers. In a privacy invasion attacks, where this was an example where a woman accidentally shared her restaurant ordering code while she was sharing food photos. And so other people picked up on that ordering code, and they ordered $60,000 worth of food on her credit card. So be careful when you're sharing things that you're not sharing QR codes that give away the bank account to people. And then there's brushing scams. So this I thought was really, really weird because the scammers send an unsolicited package to your house. And they say often it will appear to come from Amazon. And they open it up, and inside there will be a piece of paper saying report problems to Amazon, just scan this QR code. And then you scan it, it takes you to some malicious site or something like that. But this is a pretty expensive way of scamming people, I think. You know, what's the percentage of people that are actually going to fall for it and decide to scan it rather than just going to Amazon or whatever? I don't know.
What happens if they like what's in the package?
Yeah, I don't know. This seems to be just too bizarre. So some interesting stats on pushing. It increased tenfold between 2021 and 2024. So it's becoming more and more prevalent. And they say that QR codes are taking on real prominence when it comes to paying for things. So global payments using QR codes expected to exceed US $2.7 trillion this year. There's more info in the show notes for Smashing Security 412. And so if you're interested in all of that sort of stuff and links to other articles that support all of these problems with QR codes, check it out.
So the question is, what's that QR code? Where does that go?
Try it. It goes to opcug.ca.
Sure.
That does.
OPCUG.
I was looking for something to put up there as the QR code. So I decided to create a QR code for opcug.ca. So that's where it
is. Doesn't your phone automatically tell you what the URL is for QR code?
So we had a comment on the from Steve. Doesn't your phone show you where it's going to take you? Yes, it does, but if you don't happen to look at it closely, you might just click on it. But yeah, most scanners like that on the phone will let you know where you're going.
So do they put in an URL that looks like what it's supposed to be?
Could be. So the question was, do they put in a URL that looks like where you're expecting to go? And I would guess yes, but they could put in anything they want. Who knows what the scammers are going to do? So how do you protect yourself? Education. So people here, you're already aware of the issues and things like that. So stay informed on it and share your knowledge with people that are less knowledgeable about it. So Stu says, some time ago I mentioned mobile app intercept X from Sophos had a QR code scanner in it. Yeah, it does too. And it will tell you where it's going to take you as well. Verify the source. So before you scan anything, make sure you verify the legitimacy of it. And be cautious of any QR codes that are just in unusual places, public places where people could cover them up with a malicious link or whatever, or anything unexpected. Use secure QR code scanners. So you want to make sure that, like Steve said, where the URL will pop up when you just aim your camera at it so you know where you're going to be going. But again, in that, if they have something that looks like Amazon.ca or whatever, maybe they replace the character or Unicode character or something like that, you have to be careful about that. And then they say a lot of the scammers will use URL shorteners. So you'll see the URL it's going to. It's a tiny URL or something like that. You still don't know where it's going to take you. So be careful. Avoid scanning random QR codes. So anything unexpected, situation, suspicious context, flyers on the street, things like that, don't scan them. Leverage phishing-resistant multi-factor authentication. So on all your online accounts, if you have multi-factor authentication, if you are taken to a malicious site and you happen to give away your username and password to something, it's still not enough. They're going to need that second factor authentication before they can actually compromise your account. And the bottom line, maybe just avoid scanning any QR codes. So if you're interested, take a look at the Smash and Security podcast. I thought it was quite entertaining, and that's all I had on that.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. And next up we have a presentation on Gadget Pack from the Easter Bunny.
Thank you, Alan.
Very good. So, can you hear me at the back, everybody here? Okay. So, we're at the Emerald Plaza here with a big crowd. And I'm going to ask the crowd, does anybody know what gadgets are? We have an answer. Very good. Congratulations. Oh, my gosh.
The eggs are flying everywhere. The crowd's going crazy at the Emerald Plaza here. There's Easter eggs flying. Okay, we have another answer over here. Okay, the eggs are flying here. We've lost the screen, Ellen. I've lost the screen here, too. I get to no shit this screen. Down there? Very good. Okay, the excitement here, down? Okay, very good. Easter eggs are flying and the crowd is, they're pretty rowdy here. So, today we're talking about Gadget Pack. I want to share with you today. I'm using gadgets now for a long time, right? Long time. So long, I forgot it wasn't part of Windows. And so, for those that don't know, what happened to desktop gadgets? For those that don't know, desktop gadgets were a feature first introduced with Windows 7, but they were removed by Microsoft with Windows 8. But some folks, like me, kept on using gadgets. Gadgets were really cool. They gave you instant access to information that you really needed to know and really wanted to have on your desktop. So when Microsoft removed the gadgets from Windows 8, a fellow from Germany called Helmut Bühler made some software called the 8 Gadget Pack to bring back gadgets into Windows. It was free, and over time, the name changed to just Gadget Pack. I've been using desktop gadgets now for about 15 years, at home and at work. So I've always had gadgets on my desktop, and recently when Chris showed off his power toys and fancy zones, it inspired me to get a few new monitors, which gave me even more space for more gadgets. So you might ask, why not use widgets? They're built into Windows. Well, the gadgets always stay in the desktop. They stay visible, and they're very handy. And the Gadget Pack comes with over 60 gadgets. And widgets, some widgets you gotta pay for with Microsoft Store. But these are all 60, and they're awesome. You don't need 60, of course, but you get the ones that you would like. Two or three probably be lots. Now, in doing research for this presentation, I came across an article from Tom's Hardware, and it mentions why you should use desktop gadgets instead of widgets in Windows 10 or 11. So I didn't need convincing, but this verifies some of the thoughts that I had, that they're practical, convenient, and they're very easy to use. And I don't know if Tom is the same Tom we have here. He's moonlighting, but anyway. So what gadgets are available here? There's quite a selection. You can see in here, there's a wide range. You get these all in one download here. And they're varied from tools to clocks, calendars, system monitors, weather updates. They keep on going here. The gadgets, the crowd's going wild here. Anyway. So what gadgets are available? Another slide right here, page 2. You can see they're impressive. Some are practical, some are visual, some are just plain fun. You can mix and match the ones you want to use. And so we keep on going. This is a lot of gadgets. You might see that there's tons of them here with all one download here. So you might think 60 is a lot, but you haven't seen anything yet. This is just the surface. See, each of these gadgets has multiple setups. So, for instance, one desktop clock expands into 9 clocks. You pick the one that you want, and then you're still not finished. You set it up just the way you want, with secondhand and other little minor little tweaks. You can set it up yourself the way you want your gadgets to look. So this is what I'm using right now with my new monitors now, thanks to Chris. I have a minimalistic clock on the left over there. Sticky notes are handy. I have a large digital calendar with a date on there. I have a CPU monitor. I don't really know how to read it, but it makes me feel smart. So it looks really cool. So anyway, and keeping on going, I have other ones here. I have a little desktop calculator on there. And each of these gadgets come with a pop-up window. So once they're on there, you are not finished. And one of the handiest ones I have, in the bottom right, the volume. It gives me a number for my volume, and it gives me a little icon to see what the volume is at. Now, Windows 11, you must click the little speaker in the corner to see what the volume is at before you play a volume, like a program or a YouTube video. So I can see what it's set at all the time in real-time stuff. So, and going back to the calendar here, we have the calendar. This is an example that the adjustments you make for yourself are intense. Like, you can set these things up to exactly the way you want, and that's kind of fun for me. So you might ask, why is Gadget Pack 3? Well, it's a passion project by Helmut from Germany. There's no ads, there's no paid versions. It's just cool fun, and you download it once in here. You download this from gadgetpack.net. It's a really small program, 17 megabytes. You pop that on your computer, and it's tiny. But you get all 60 gadgets with all customizations in one download, but you may only use 2 or 3. Anyway, here's the website. Very clean looking here. And I was worried as I evolved from different versions of Windows, I really didn't care. I wanted to have the gadgets. And you can see it's still being updated and maintained. And that's thanks to Helmut. And I like gadgets. And we got more crowd just came into the room here. Here we have Easter egg. There. But the crowds are coming in. Thank you very much, folks. Thank you. Okay. Over to Alan and Chris now.
Okay, we can't have him anymore, okay?
Okay, thank you very much, Bob. The crowd enjoyed that. Where are we up to? We need another slide. Okay, we're talking about doing things for free and for the subs and likes. Here's Dave's Garage. This is that guy from the old days of Microsoft Windows 95. So he was a Microsoft systems engineer. And this is one of his recent videos on YouTube. The real reason Windows is free and what it costs you. And his thesis basically is it was free because everybody else started giving away operating systems. Linux came on board and Apple started to give updates to their macOS software away for free. So Windows basically felt it had to jump on the bandwagon and give out Windows updates for free. So that's why going from Windows 7 to Windows 10 was actually free, and going from Windows 10 to Windows 11, if you can do it, is also free. But then what does it cost you? Well, he talks about Windows moving to Windows as a service, maybe a subscription. That didn't really happen, at least not yet. But the other thing is they're using a lot of applications like Office 365 or Microsoft 365 as it is now is a subscription service. So you have to keep paying for it. And they have all kinds of other things like Azure, the cloud-based AI, all kinds of cloud-based services, which they're basically marketing to industry. Commercially. So they're making lots of money off the kind of subsidiary things to the operating system. The operating system's free, but they're making money other ways. And of course, one of the ways was data. And in the good old days, they would download everything that you were doing, and to help them, they say, to help them improve the software. And of course, the naysayers felt that that was a big red flag, and giving stuff away and then taking data says that if you're not paying for the product, then you're actually the product. So it was your data that was important to them. Now, they say that it's all to radically improve the system, and it's no different from macOS and especially Android, Google's Android system. They all do the same thing. They a lot of telemetry to find out what's going on and hopefully improve things for us. Anyway, I thought it was a really interesting an interesting take from an ex-Microsoft guy on what Microsoft's up to basically these days. Now, clearly, he's not speaking for Microsoft, so a lot of his stuff is conjecture and speculation, but interesting nevertheless. Okay, how are we doing? Windows Update Error. I think this is where I finished off last week with this issue on one of my machines that doesn't want to install this cumulative update for Windows 10 and wanted me to retry all the time. Chris had mentioned that a while back we'd had a thing on how to fix update when it wouldn't work properly. So I looked up on the index to the Q&A sessions, and I look for items on Windows Update, and there were, 10 listings there. And eventually I found this one that's Windows Update is broken from late February in 2024. And when I look at that presentation, then there's this set of instructions here to run in a command window. You have to run it as run command as an administrator, and then you add all these different commands, stopping various services, renaming a couple of files, and then restarting all the services, reboot the computer, and then run update again. And of course, it fails miserably yet again. So the other thing you can do is run the, there were problems downloading some updates. We'll try again later. Yeah, if you keep seeing this, yeah. So the other thing to do is run the troubleshooter, and of course the troubleshooter fails miserably also. So I'm still not out of the woods on this machine. It has its little problems, but one of these days Microsoft may fix it. Or alternatively, on October the 14th, I think it is this year, Windows 10 will stop working altogether, so it won't be a problem. There we go. Right. Okay, so we're in the last 10. We're in the last 25 or something, I think. The last 30, I don't know. So does anybody have any questions, comments, or things that they would like to share? Anything in the chat, Chris?
I'm just getting back to that. I don't think we've got anybody in the chat now.
For those of you who didn't come, the people in the house have chocolate.
Yeah.
We have cookies. So you should have come, guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go ahead. Question from the floor.
I think things are just about everything that has sound, that you cannot change the volume without unmuting. Anyways, I want to be able to change the volume on my noise making device without unmuting it. I want it to be quiet, and I want to set the volume so it'll be different next time I put it on. My TV doesn't have that. My phone doesn't have that. You ever heard of anything having that?
Maybe, Chris, you have to chip the relay that?
No,
actually, I think everybody heard of it. I heard it through the Zoom itself. So if anybody on the Zoom call has an idea how to do that, so change the volume control without unmuting. I don't see anybody come up with that.
Your desktop gadget will do that. I believe it will.
Yeah.
I'm sure that I don't have to. It stays visible. As long as you can see the icon, and you can have the icon on any monitor, and you can adjust your volume and see what it's at.
You can always change it down.
It doesn't just show you what it's at. You can change it using the gadget. The gadget's new.
Unless I'm misunderstanding, at the bottom right of your window, there is a button for the volume, and you can adjust the volume to any level you want. So.
Yeah, but Josh suggested that you can adjust the volume to anything you want. The problem is, if you set it muted, and then you change the volume, it unmutes it automatically.
I see.
And I just checked it here on my Windows 11 and it does that.
Am I the only person in the universe who ever thought of this? When my TV is on, I want to change the volume, but I don't want it to come, like you say, I've got the volume set at 80, but I don't want it to blast.
Tom, do you have something?
Yes, it only unmutes when you turn the volume up. So if you want your volume to come on slowly, then turn your volume all the way down while it's muted, and then start turning it up.
Let me just test that. Well, on Windows 11, Tom's idea was that it only unmuted if you increase the volume, but I just tested it here on Windows 11. If I mute it and then I go up or down, it unmutes it automatically.
Doesn't Windows 10 stays muted?
He says that in Windows 10, if you unmute, if you leave it muted and you lower the volume, it doesn't change it. It doesn't unmute you.
I just tried it and it works for me.
And you're on Windows 10 as well, Steve?
Yep.
Yeah, he's on Windows 10 as well. So Windows 10, you can do volume down, but not up.
Until I get the VR. Until I get the VR stuff figured out.
There's also the on top button on your microphone that might help also.
Also, Windows 11, it also works. So I don't know why it isn't working on yours.
It's definitely not on mine. If I mute the speaker and then I volume up, it unmutes. And if I go volume down, it unmutes.
Well, are you using the icon in the system tray of Windows?
Yeah, that's from the icon in the system tray.
Okay.
Interesting. Well, if we don't have anything else, do people want my latest rant? I was saving this for next week, but we'll go ahead because we've got a lot of time left. So I'm going to go ahead.
Okay, because maybe this time next week you'll have a new one.
I could well have that. Yeah.
It's okay, it's all, Chris.
Okay, so this is my latest rant. So it's all about password restrictions. And I've been giving a presentation on keeping passwords safe over 20 times. And so I do take passwords seriously. I do realize that passwords are important, and it's important to have strong passwords. And I fully support websites requiring strong passwords as well, especially if they follow the latest NIST guidelines, which is the government agency in the United States that does a lot of standards and things like that. They just published an update to their password guidelines last August, I believe it is. However, requirements that don't make sense really frustrate me. And I recently ran into a case where it really frustrated me. So I needed a new account on, and I won't say what website it was. I think this is something that a lot of them will actually do. And so this was just egregious. When I was asked for an account, I decided, okay, I'm going to make a good password. So I'm going to make it 21 characters long. I'm going to make it a complex password, even though I don't believe that that's really necessary. So it's going to include uppercase and lowercase letters, number, a special character. So what I did is I went into my password manager and I created a new entry for this unnamed website, which I named here Weird Restrictions Website. And I came up with this password, if a password don't work, 9!! And with uppercase and lowercase and things like that. So I thought that was a pretty good password. So I copied the password to the clipboard.
And I would have guessed that straight off.
What's that?
I would have guessed that one straight off.
Yeah, of course.
Especially with the number 9 in it.
Yeah, giveaway. That makes it more difficult for sure. So then I went back to the sign-in screen, and or actually the sign-up screen, put my cursor in the password field, and I hit Control-V to paste it from the clipboard. And nothing happened. I tried again. I thought, oh, maybe something weird happened. I was ending up with a graphic was on my clipboard or something like that. So I went, copied it again from my password manager, hit Control-V, nothing. The website, it turns out, they had actually disabled the ability to paste from the clipboard into password.
I've seen that, Jerry.
Yeah. I mean, it's possible to do, and I knew it was possible, but not many of them will actually go to the trouble of doing that.
Wow.
So what the frick? So then I had to type in that password manually. So now I'm twice. I'm faced with a complex password that is not easy for me to remember and things like that. So, okay, I'll type it in. So I typed it in, and I typed it in the second time.
And I'm marking that.
Must include a special character. Well, this is interesting because I had a special character, the exclamation mark. And exclamation mark, they came up with a list of characters that were special characters, and exclamation mark was on the list. So I picked, what the frig again? So I took the eyeball to reveal the password. And, oh, I missed the exclamation mark. So I go, and I type in the exclamation mark at the end of the password. And only 20 characters were permitted. So it wouldn't take the exclamation mark. That's why it came up saying no special character in your password. So again, I repeat, what the frig? So I changed my password from, if a password don't work, 9 exclamation mark. I put the exclamation mark in place of the lowercase a at the start of it all. And then I got an error message, restricted words not permitted. And it didn't say what the restricted word was. I sort of took a guess at it. I figured they didn't like the fact that I used password in the middle of my password. So I took a guess at that.
And you changed the A to?
Yeah.
Well, I could do that. I could change anything. So my explainer... My rants got worse. So I decided to change my password to include exclamation mark, at, pound signs, asterisk, S. And it finally worked. So I thought that this was really, really stupid, that they had so many restrictions in place. First off, requiring complexity in password is no longer recommended by NIST at all. They say you should not require complexity. Go for length over complexity, and it's much easier for people to actually deal with. And you should not restrict it to 20 characters, some of that. They should permit up to 64 characters or more is what NIST is recommending. So they're making things difficult. And they're just not allowing people to easily deal with passwords. I think.
Stu says various platforms will create a password. Was that not an option?
Sorry?
I think Stu's comment there in the chat was that various platforms will permit creating a password. Was that not an option for?
Creating a random password, maybe?
It will create one for you, I think.
Actually, most say, oh, yeah, that's true. Some of them do. But I think it's actually more the browser that is actually offering to do that in most cases where you get that offering to create a password. It's built into the password manager in Chrome and things like that. I think it's coming from Chrome as opposed to coming from the website.
Stu said Apple does it.
Yeah. I mean, if they have the capability of generating it for you, I suppose that's one way to connect. As long as they allow you to copy it so you can paste it in your password manager. Because I don't want to have to do it manually, transcribe it in that direction either. So I think it's just a little bit ridiculous, the steps they made me go through in order to have a password that would work on their particular site. Now, I will say as well that the May 1st, I believe, is the World Password Day. So next week I will have another share talking about passwords in particular and NIST guidelines and things like that. So you'll have that to look forward to just before World Password Day. But for now, I just thought I'd get this rant out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
And for the benefit of Mr. Harris, all these graphics were all generated by ChatGPT. So ChatGPT is actually getting quite inventive. You can upload your own photos. And this one, I just uploaded a headshot, and then I told it to make a caricature and various expressions and things like that. And it's actually doing a very credible job.
Chris,
that's all I have on that.
Chris?
Yeah.
Do you have time for a couple of password questions?
Sure.
Okay, you being the wizard of all password things, password. First of all, why can't they come up with a standard set of allowed special characters? Why do you have to wonder whether this particular special character is allowed by this particular website?
So for the benefit of Google on Zoom, the question was, why don't they have a standard set of characters that are considered to be special characters? And I think the short answer to it is that there are some 32,000 Unicode characters available to them. And if you can get anybody to agree on the standard set from that, good luck. Now, it is partially done, actually, because Microsoft actually defined early on in the days of, I guess it was XP, Windows NT, they defined a set of 32 special characters. And I think a lot of people actually use that same 32 characters. But it is not universal, for sure.
Okay. Second question?
Yep.
I don't understand the rationale for long and complex passwords, period. I mean, what is the goal of having a long, complex password? To make it hard to guess, right?
It's not just guess. It's a matter of using rainbow tables on passwords. So what they can do is when you go and put in your password into a website,
mm-hmm.
what they do is they store a hash of your password.
Right.
So the next time you come along, you put in your password, they do the hash algorithm. If it matches the hash that they've got stored, then you're permitted in. So what you can do is you can pre-compute all of the hashes for fairly lengthy, complex passwords. And you can do them up to, I think, fairly easily now up to about 13 or 14 characters for sure. And probably beyond that is reasonable storage requirements, in which case you can instantly crack any passwords if you have the hashes. So if you can download the password hashes from a hacked website, then you can reverse engineer them, really, if you have them. Done. So the complexity makes it that there's more possible passwords on there, and it makes it just harder for it to pre-compute it.
Yeah, I guess I'm going to have to redo our hashes because I don't understand why there are fewer hashes than passwords. I mean, at 12 character random, out of all the, I don't know, the 64 ASCII characters, if you make a 12 character random character password, the number of possibilities is astronomical.
Astronomical enough. That's the problem. A password cracking array can go through tens or hundreds of millions of password guesses per second. So that's where the problem really comes in.
Yeah.
That you need it that it just
but,
is.
But
it.
Surely you must be a limit of like 16 characters.
Well, actually, let me
suggesting 64.
let, Let me bring up a website here. Am I sharing this?
Yes.
Let me bring up a web browser. Sure. Oh, I'm not sharing my whole desktop. Hang on a second. I'm going to have to stop the share. And then I'm going to reshare. Well, actually, let me get the web browser up first. Now let me share the web browser.
You're looking for the page that tells you how long it takes to crack so many characters, right?
Yeah, there is a website that Steve Gibson at Gibson Research actually has. That moves some controls out of the way here a little bit.
Yeah, so it ranges from almost instantaneously to millions of years.
Yeah. How big is your haystack rather than your stomach? So this is started out by Steve Gibson. So let's do a 16-character alphanumeric password, okay? So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16.
No numbers.
Yeah, I just said alphanumeric. Oh, sorry, just alpha. So we have 52 possible characters for each position. The search space, there's actually 2.91 times 10 to the 27th possible passwords if you're doing that. And this one here, an offline attack, massive cracking array. Actually, that's not bad. It would take 9.27 thousand centibytes. So yeah, actually, that is pretty good. But if we change this to something that is, okay. So there's 16 characters. And it now will take 1.4 100 million centuries. Yeah, you're correct. And that, even a 16-character password.
What is it for 12? Because 12 is the one I'm giving
you. Oh, okay. So let's go down to 12. So, okay, let's take this back to take out the numbers and special characters. So 1.52 months it could take to crack that password. If you know that it's only uppercase and lowercase letters,
right,
with a massive cracking array. So.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. But length wins over complexity. So if I'm recommending typically at least 18 characters, but non-complex. And so if we just add in a couple of more characters in here.
Does he have a section in there where it gives you it? Based on the qubit?
Basically, I should think.
Sorry, Steve, what was that?
Yeah, if he uses a qubit rather than a regular bit.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be. I think all bets are off.
It's going to be instead of millions of centuries, it's millionths of a second.
Yeah.
Because it'll do all 25 trillion.
And quantum computing.
Quantum computing, all bets are off.
Yeah, exactly. On that. But if you go into just a 18-character, non-complex, so just uppercase and lowercase, and actually, let's even take out the uppercase, all lowercase. It makes a big difference, but still, massive cracking array to crack that by just randomly choosing that, and you're assuming the person knows you only use lowercase letters, it could still be 9.97 centuries to go through that entire search space. So length is the big winner on that. And so I've always recommended people always go for long, but don't worry about complexity, because it's a lot easier to deal with password afterwards. So when you have to type it in manually or whatever. However, there's nothing wrong with complexity. So if you have a password manager and you never have to type it in, you can throw in complexity as well. It doesn't hurt.
But why would anybody bother with 64-character password? And anybody suggests that to me, I say, don't be silly.
Yeah, 64-character password would be a little bit outside of the realm of capability of even running rainbow tables where you pre-compute the hashes. It's not practical to have the disk space available to store those rainbow tables.
How about actual words rather than this?
It's more easily cracked if, the question Bridget brought up here was, what if you use regular words? Is it more practical? If it is a phrase that is recognizable, yes. So where no man has gone before is a very bad idea. This password is secret is very bad. And the reason behind that is that the attackers who are trying these brute force attacks, they don't start with brute force attacks. They start with password. They start with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. They start with where no man has gone before, and common phrases. So they'll have a dictionary of those common words, common passwords that they will throw at it, and they will instantly crack passwords from people who have used, you know, the top 1,000 most common passwords or common phrases, things like that. Medical dictionary terms, they have all kinds of things.
Can we try maybe a few common words, not a phrase?
This is not actually checking on your strength at all. This is just the search space. So it's not looking at whether it's words or just random characters. So this particular thing. And he actually warns you on the site that it's not a password strength measurement. It's just talking about the size of the search space.
Two comments. One, if you're using the password manager, the length doesn't matter. It's the same amount of work. It's just one click. So whether it's 12 characters or 64 characters, it's the same amount of work. Cut and paste.
Yeah, the one comment I'll have for that, so Josh said that if you're using a password manager, it doesn't matter how long it is or how complex it is, you don't have to type it in. I like a password that I might remember and actually be able to type it in without having to go to my password manager. So that's why I tend to go with something that is still long, but a passphrase, four or more words that are somewhat random words and not a common phrase. So that's why I tend to go with that anyways. But your point is good, in that if you're always using a password manager, then, yeah, you don't have to type anything in. It can be as long as you want, as complex as you want.
So same amount of work.
Yeah.
Another comment is if you have people around you that sometimes can look at your computer and you don't always trust everybody, adding a bit of complexity might be a good thing in that case.
True. So shoulder surfing, if you use a phrase, then people can probably remember that a whole lot easier than if you use something like, you know, badge or with complexity added in there, numbers, special characters and things like that.
Just a little question to come back on the volume. You can, if you scroll the bar, but can you click on the scale on the specific volume?
And look. So the question is, can you click on the scale and actually choose it? So, yep, you can.
So if you select a low volume, it will be...
Well, if it's muted, it's still going to unmute you, though.
But it will start at the low volume, right?
Yeah, that's true. You could do that where you just, when you change the volume, well, you want it to be able to unmute at whatever set volume you want, though, right?
My issue is when it's already set, say the volume is set high and it's muted, in order to lower the volume, I don't want it to come on and blast me.
No, but what I'm saying is that let's say it's at 80% volume.
Yeah.
And you click on the 10, it will,
or
not,
okay.
Is that right?
Yeah.
All right.
I presume so. Let me just try that and just make sure. Whoops. So if I just, yeah, it unmutes at that volume.
Can't do that. I'm using even more.
So. Yeah. For anybody who is on the Zoom call who is not able to follow along, just some discussion about when you have it muted, if you bring it up and you go to, you want it to come unmuted at a particular volume, you click there, it comes on at that volume rather than having it where it's really high and you come in and you simply unmute it, it comes on at that high volume. So, yeah, that'd be a bit of a workaround. So, mute it, and then just click when you want to unmute it, click where you want it to be unmuted. That's it all. Okay. Any other things? We are at 8 o'clock, so I think if we don't have any other questions, we can go ahead and close off the call for today.
Tristan's just reminding people to use two-factor authentication if it's available. So if the password is ever compromised, at least you've got a second level.
At the ABCU meeting today, they had a presentation on using passkeys. And I've actually been sort of looking into passkeys a little bit. And it seems to be a nice passwordless way of going about authentication, but there's a lot of caveats in it. And if anybody wants to actually put together a more comprehensive look at passkeys and the value and the and what are the dangers of it, because often it's really tied between a website or whatever you're authenticating to and a device, whether that's your phone that has the passkey on it or your computer or whatever. And the danger I've always worried about is that what if you don't have your phone with you, then you have nothing to fall back on. So if you forgot your phone at home, all of a sudden you can't log into Gmail or whatever it is you set up for authentication. And some people say, oh, well, you can have a fallback, but you can authenticate to through another means. Well, if you have that fallback, then it's a weaker form of authentication. Why bother with passkeys in the first place? So I don't know if people want to have a more wholesome discussion, if somebody wants to put together some thoughts behind passkeys and how to get around these sort of dangers of not having your means of authentication available to you and what you do if your phone is stolen and how you get your passkeys then. But I don't know. It's a complex topic for sure. But for now, I'm sticking with passwords.
And some of the caveats are that they don't work with all devices and all operating systems.
Yeah, that's right.
I was trying to set you up on this thing, and it wouldn't accept it.
Okay.
You can always have a
wrap up there, Alan.
You can always have a backup phone and copy your authenticator codes.
I'm using one screen, and I can't.
Okay, just a second, Alan. So Tom was saying you have a backup phone with your authenticator codes on that backup device.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's what I do.
Okay. There are, just anybody who's interested here in the room, there are a bunch of chat comments talking about passwords and salting passwords and things like that. So if you're interested in getting that other background information, I'll check out the chat once it gets posted to our website.
Okay, I don't have very much, I think, for the wrap-up, but just remind people about the library presentations at Twin Hall Library. On Thursday, that will be tomorrow, Chris is doing a quick tips presentation on AI tools. That's at Rosemount. And then since we've been talking about passwords, if you want to know how to keep your passwords safe, and the Centennial Branch on April the 25th, which is Friday. That's a 2 p.m. Session. And then macro photography, I assume that one's going ahead.
Yep.
Every time I mention one of Linda's, it's been cancelled. Mackie, if you want to know all about macro photography, then Linda's doing that at Elmvale Acres on Saturday, this coming Saturday. I just remind you that if you want to go to the library sessions, you have to register ahead of time. And so just go to this link here, and that will enable you to register.
Except for the first one, how to use free AI tools in your daily life. On Thursday, tomorrow, it is full, and there's a wait list. But if you want to come, just come anyways, because there's always people who don't show up. We've never filled the room at all. So if you want to come to it, don't bother registering. You won't be able to. Just come.
Okay. Okay, and then finally, our next Q&A will be a regular on Zoom, all Zoom, all the time, next Wednesday, April the 30th. And since we're light on material tonight, if you have questions or you want follow up on things that we've talked about, if anybody knows about passkeys and can make them work, I'd be interested to learn about that. Or if you have other topics that you'd like to share, like Bob's gadgets, I have to install some gadgets on my machine now. Bob. So anything, questions, follow-ups, or topics that you'd like to share, just send us a note to the suggestion box, and we'll be happy to add you to the agenda for April the 30th. So thanks, everyone, for coming tonight. The crowd's still going wild here.
We have a reminder from Corinne to vote, if you haven't voted in the advance polls. And let's see if there's anything else. Yeah, a lot of other comments dealing with passwords, so I highly recommend people check out the chat once it goes up on our website later on today.
Tomorrow.
Oh, yeah, we're going out to the bar tonight. So.
Yeah, it's a meet you with a wing seat, folks, so if you haven't come to the library, you still can come to the wing seat.
That's true.
Are you still wearing room for us all there?
I'm sure you will.
I'm sure there will be.
So,
where is it going to be?
It's a local hero.
So the local heroes are going to local heroes. There.
And those online, it's not too late to join us.
Yeah,
that's right.
That's for little miles.
Just across the road somewhere on Merivale Road. Okay, so thanks everyone for attending tonight. Hope you enjoyed it. And we'll see you next week.